The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Yeah. Hello, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started. You have before you an expert on employee benefits law. I teach labor and employment law, and Professor Wiley teaches a whole range of health law subjects. And we thought we'd start by figuring out who you were here to hear. So, in other words, what subject, what of this range of things? Absolutely not that. Since you don't know us, you couldn't possibly do that. But just what subject areas you're here to?
Labor and employment.
Okay.
Labor and
employment. Oh, okay. Okay, so it's a mix. Okay, we weren't sure. Okay. So do you want to go first?
I'm happy to start. Professor Corl and I are doubly booked at lunch today for something else as well.
But that's okay. I don't either. You do, I don't.
Are you interested in pension and employee benefits as part of your labor and employment law issue?
Perhaps. Right now I'm leaning more to discrimination, but I don't know. You know, I think I'll probably figure it out as I intern.
Right.
Are you two L's or three L's?
I'm one L.
They should all be one L's.
Yeah, we'll be
too. Okay. I teach a course in ERISA, which is the federal pension law, and it not only governs pension benefits, but it also governs the provision of welfare, health, and other types of benefits through the employment relationship. And it is a statutory course geared towards ERISA, which is the fundamental statute. But it's an area that's really very interesting because it touches on so many other areas, and it's an opportunity to think about a portion of it is tax, a portion of it is the law is premised on trust law. It tracks trust law but departs in various areas. So you've got trust law. You've got a fair amount of financial products and financial institutions because pension interests represent probably the largest single investor on Wall Street in, it's $18 trillion. So figuring out what products are suitable for pension investing, how pensions invest their funds, so we have a fair amount of financial sophistication in the course. Bankruptcy, of course, because bankruptcy has become a way to control liabilities other than multi-district litigation for things like torts, pension liabilities, and other things. So you see a lot of things resolving ultimately in the bankruptcy forum. General corporate merger and acquisition law, because a huge piece of that is, what am I getting in terms of the workforce and benefits that I'm responsible for. So it's a course that touches on a fair amount of this. I sort of also regard it as basic financial literacy, but my goal in teaching this course really is to put each of you in a position. It's an area where hiring is still, we hope, going on, and to put you in a position to have a leg up and to even compete with, if it says a year's worth of experience, you're going to argue that you've had a course that most other law schools don't offer at the JD level, and an opportunity to go for something there. If you're interested, on Wednesday of this week, we run an annual conference, the first half of which we have the Assistant Secretary of Labor for Pension and Welfare Benefits. We have this year the Chief Counsel for the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation and some practitioners in town talking about new developments in the area. And always the second half is sponsored by the premier ERISA boutique in Washington, probably nationally. And they will be putting on a careers panel talking to you. They're mostly young associates talking to you about what opportunities are out there. A number of the people speaking are people who have sort of chosen to meld their interest in ERISA and the Patient Protection Act and to become experts in the healthcare area. And they will tell you what opportunities are out there. So please, there's the flyer, and you have to sign up ahead of time through Jennifer Dabson's office. We'd love to have you. And that's a good way to hear about what's going on.
And also a great panel for those of you interested in health law, because as Professor Bromowitz said, that one of the really exciting areas for hiring right now is at the intersection of ERISA and health law, and that's where some of your practitioners on the panel are working now.
I've heard that it's really smart to take a class in ERISA. Is it offered both in the fall and spring?
Just in the spring.
Just in the spring. Okay.
But there are other subjects to take as well.
Yes, absolutely. That would complement that.
No,
and I think you should.
I'm thinking in the tax area.
Yes. I don't require anything as a prerequisite because I welcome all and we'll just teach to whatever level we get. And different people are pulling different things out of this. But labor law, of course, when I was talking about the constituent pieces, labor law is a huge piece of this. Do you offer that in the fall or the spring or both?
Labor law is always offered both. Well, I'll explain how our labor and employment curriculum fits together, but it's offered both fall and spring. And there's a sort of a basic class and a more advanced class.
Okay. And we also, converge with Title VII also because we're also talking about the Age Discrimination Act, age and gender issues, which come up in the pension area also. That was our topic last week, so... I'm going to stop there. If you have questions, please feel free to ask or feel free to pop into a class.
Where's the conference?
The conference is in room 603 from 3 to 7. The first hour 20 is the government panel and others, and the second panel starting at about 4:20 or 4:30 is the careers panel with the younger lawyers, and then Gruma Nordberg always does a reception for us afterwards at 6.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that you make the same offer. When you're coming to these events, don't ever hesitate to speak to a professor if there's someone you'd like to be introduced to on the panel.
Absolutely.
And you're not as comfortable approaching them yourself. You can always... sort of let one of us know that you'd particularly like to be introduced to someone on the panel. And that can be a really important networking opportunity.
Excellent.
So you're free?
I'm free. I'll wait for you to go together.
You
want me to go?
Okay.
If anyone has any questions, my office is 444B. I hope to see you on Wednesday. Come. Worst comes to worst, at least the hors d'oeuvres are usually quite good.
See you. Bye-bye. I thought I would just outline how our curriculum fits together in the labor and employment law area. I'll be very quick about it. So for those of you who have background, you already probably know this, but the way people think about the labor and employment law field, which is actually very vast and is an area where people are still hiring, people often... kind of think of part of it as anti-discrimination law, which is Title VII, Age Discrimination Employment Act, the Americans with Disability Act, and some other things, Pay Discrimination Act. That's like the big elephant in the room these days, as you might know. There's just a lot of doctrine and law. That's a very large part of labor and employment law. Then there's another part. And it's very much an individual employment rights kind of paradigm, shall we say. It's focused on the individual rights, the rights of the individual to be free of discrimination. Then there's another big area that's sort of other kinds of individual employment rights law, and that includes things like minimum wage, maximum hours, the Fair Labor Standards Act fits in there, and a bunch of other things. Workers' compensation, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, OSHA, maybe that overlaps a little bit here. So OSHA, Fair Labor Standards Act, workers' comp. And then there's another field, which is labor law, which is collectively bargained law, where you have a union in the workplace. And so they're sort of, they overlap. I mean for OSHA to overlap here. Very good at drawing. There's a lot of overlap among the courses, and then there are some other related topics like the ERISA area, which kind of relates to labor law. You heard Professor Abram would say it relates somewhat to anti-discrimination law, not that much, I don't think. Tax, I would say, is pretty big.
things like sex-based discrimination and disability rights, which are all related to the anti-discrimination aspects. So what we try to do here, this is all a setup to something that will make sense to you in a minute. We try to divide up this vast area into what seems to us to make the most sense in order to map the field, while also trying to explain the way that the different parts of the field relate. So we have a course called Employment Discrimination. Right, that's one course. We offer that every semester, sometimes both in the daytime and the nighttime. And that's going to cover all of your Title VII, all the anti-discrimination statutes, with a focus on federal law, but some discussion of state law. Then we have another course that's called Labor and Employment Law, and that's this part right here. And so it tries to cover everything that's not covered in the anti-discrimination course while carving out anti-discrimination law, though we do have an adjunct here who insists on teaching anti-discrimination law in his course, but, you know, what can you do? He's an expert in the field. We love him. We're not going to, you know, not going to tell him not to teach a course, so we accept that. So, and that's the second course, and you'll have some variation in what professors will emphasize in that course depending on their own areas of interest and expertise, but you should be getting kind of that kind of coverage there. Then we have an advanced course in labor law, which is taught by Harold Datz, and he is really an expert in labor law and somebody I used to write to when I practiced labor law all the time because he was the head of the Office of Advice at the NLRB at that time. Then he became general counsel to the NLRB, and then he retired, and now he teaches here, so we're lucky to have him. We're hoping at some point to offer an advanced employment law course for people that would cover kind of the issues that involving high-salaried executive type issues, though we cover some of that in the basic course as well. And then we have other courses that touch on a lot of these issues, including the disability rights seminar, which has a big chunk of employment discrimination law in it, and the sex-based discrimination class, same thing. So that's kind of how our curriculum works overall, just so you understand it, because it is a little, it's not transparent if you don't understand why we're doing what we're doing or how it works. We also have some courses that kind of come off here, that belong in here, including Professor Ratoda offers a low-income and immigrant workers rights class, which is an excellent class here. So that's sort of the low-income labor issue, employment issues, I think, more. We have a course in here that is International Labor Rights course, which is taught by Professor Hernstad, who is an expert in that area. And we may have some other courses that are slipping my mind. We have some courses. J.D. Chuang teaches a course on, sometimes it's called Workers in the Global Economy, which is looking sort of at demographics of migration and labor populations moving across national borders and the international law issues that are raised with that. She also teaches a trafficking course, which raises labor and employment law issues as well. So there are some seminars and other courses that will relate to labor and employment law, maybe more in the international law area. So that's in terms of what to take, I would say it depends a lot on where you think you're headed. Of course, you don't know yet. And I'm very happy to meet with people and talk to you in my office, which is in room 408. And you can sign up for my office hours through MyWCL by clicking on the Instructor Office Hours app or whatever it is. And then you can just sign up. Or if those hours don't work for you, you can email me. But if you want sort of a general background in labor and employment law issues, probably the two courses to take are the big ones. The survey courses, the anti-discrimination one, and the labor and employment law one. And then you can fill in with the more narrowly defined courses and seminars to sort of pursue your area of greatest interest.
I'm happy to answer questions.
Because you have a...
I also have to run to this, but I'm not in a big hurry. I don't have to be there. I've just been encouraged to be there. It's not a have to do.
Just a quick question. You mentioned that there still is some hiring going on.
Is there
a certain specific area that is, I mean, I don't want to base, you know, what I want to do on just that, but is there a specific area that's still strong, like more than another area?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Everything about the legal, and my other subject is legal professional, legal ethics, so I'm interested in this in two directions. And you may have thoughts about this too. Everything about legal hiring in the present climate is kind of in flux. So the smaller firms, which tend to do the individual client service stuff, they're kind of the same as always. And in fact, overall, they are by far generating more jobs for new lawyers than the big firm sector is, which has dramatically declined. I'm writing an article on this right now, so I'm really focused on this. And that's going to be all of the firms that do both individual employment rights, anti-discrimination rights on the plaintiff side, and plaintiffs or union side labor law firms. They're all hiring at about the same level they always did, which isn't a lot of hiring every year because they're smaller firms that are only replacing, you know, every few years they might hire one or two people. But my students are going into those jobs today. The management side, labor law firms, and the big firms that did some employment counseling and employment litigation, their hiring is way off from before. So that's the other thing, you know, people tend to specialize in this area, not exclusively, but people tend to lean more towards representing employers or more towards representing employees. So that hiring is off. And then in the last, since Obama was elected, federal government hiring in the labor and employment law area was really going gangbusters, and we were probably placing 3 or 4 students at the NLRB every year and 3 to 8 students at the Labor Department, and that was really nice. That was great. With the sequester, I think that hiring really did, you know, there was always a hiring freeze. The federal government always has a hiring freeze for new lawyers, but people were still getting hired. This year, with the sequester, really, it really is stopped. Now, how long that will be, we don't really know, right? It can't be forever. It's probably going to be at least for a year. I mean, I would say even if they fix it at a political level, it'll be a while before things start, you know, churning within the agencies. So that kind of affects things a lot. So as Professor Obama was saying, the one place where you can, the sort of full employment for lawyers area is ERISA. But you have to understand, it's a supply-demand thing. There's a reason why people who like to do ERISA and are good at it get hired, which is there are not that many people who love ERISA and are good at it. It takes a certain kind of mindset. And sometimes people are really attracted to the sort of principles underlying labor and employment law. They're not as interested in the nitty-gritty detail kind of stuff that goes along with being a really good ERISA lawyer. But if it turns out you do like it, then that's a really good area to go in. But, you know, it's also not everyone's cup of tea. So that's kind of a vague answer, but it's the best I can give you.
Any other labor equipment questions? Do you want to stick around?
I want to take off if that's okay.
Sure.
408, happy to talk to anybody individually, both about courses and also if you're thinking about summer jobs or that kind of thing. I'm really more than happy to talk about labor and employment all day long. So, nice to meet you all.
Can I ask a question, actually, because it's related to something that I'll say about on the health side. On the health side in HHS, they externships are really, really important if you're interested in going into a government position. Would you say that that's also true?
Yes.
For Department of Labor and LLRB, to exist.
I would say for all of the jobs that we talked about, which is private sector government jobs, having a demonstrated interest in the field is absolutely key, and the way you do that is by having work experiences on your resume, either before law school or during law school, that show that you have some background, that you know what you're talking about. When if you go to somebody and you say, "I'm dying to do labor law," and they look on your resume and you've never had any labor law experience in your entire life, how did you know you're dying to do labor law? "I love the course." Well, practicing is kind of really different from what you might learn in a course. So I think it's really basically for any field you're headed in, you need to have some experience. And I think employers like to see that you've had several different, really different experiences. So you've maybe worked for a nonprofit and you've worked for a government agency or something like that, and you've worked for a law firm. Like, that looks better than three government agency jobs, at least in labor and employment. I don't know if that's true.
Yeah.
But definitely you do want to take advantage of our externship program and in the summer, even if you don't get paid, which you probably won't, especially after first year, but to have something on your resume that shows that you have some exposure to what it's like to actually work in the field. So when you say you know this is what you want to do, you sound convincing.
So we also had somebody just joined us. Maybe we should check. Yeah. Labor and employment or health or both? Okay.
So I'm going to split. Okay, good.
So I can do the same. I can give you a quick overview. And those of you who aren't interested in health, it won't hurt my feelings. Take a cookie on your way out. They're good. I can give you a quick overview of our health law curriculum and the different areas of health law that we offer here, and then happy to answer any questions that you have. So the starting point, although it doesn't have to be the first course that you take, is the health law survey course, and that's offered in each semester. So in the fall, we have an evening course taught by two adjuncts. And in the spring, I teach a day course. So they're interchangeable. They're two sections of the same survey course. That course is mostly on the law of healthcare delivery and financing. So one of the distinctions I'll draw is between healthcare, meaning medical treatment, you know, in a hospital by doctors, pharmacists, that sort of thing, and the financing of healthcare on the one hand, and health law outside of just healthcare financing. Delivery, and we have some courses that are in those other areas. So the survey course is mostly that healthcare financing and delivery stuff. Then if you're interested in that area, in that core area of healthcare financing and delivery, there are two other smaller courses, fewer credits, that I highly recommend that you take if you decide that you really want to pursue practice in that field. And those are the fraud and abuse course taught by Asha Shelzo in the fall and the health information privacy course taught by Alan Goldberg, I believe in the spring, although I forgot to bring my notes, so I don't remember what's scheduled when. So if you know you're interested in healthcare financing and delivery, those are the three courses that you absolutely should have on your transcript. Those are the three kind of main areas. Whether you want to represent healthcare providers or insurance companies or individual patients working with an NGO, those are the three areas. Another sort of subfield within that healthcare financing and delivery that's going to be covered in the survey course, but there's also a course you can take that explores it in more depth, is medical liability. And that's the stuff that you've been exposed to through your torts course. Medical malpractice law, I mean, I think virtually every torts course includes at least a few med mal cases, but there are several areas of doctrine that are sort of specific to med mal. And so if you're interested in doing that kind of work, and there is still hiring going on there, actually just a student just got a job at one of those sort of smaller mid-sized firms doing med mal defense just the other day. If you're interested in doing that work, I highly recommend the medical malpractice. It's called medical liability, rather, course. And that one's taught by, in the past it's been taught by Steve Pavsner. This next year it's going to be taken over by a new adjunct in Katie Bertram, who's been a frequent guest teacher in my course as well as in Pavsner's course. And she's fantastic because she's got she's got sort of like the typical career path of someone in this field. She started out doing defense side med mal at a law firm. Then she went in-house at a hospital at Georgetown University Medical Center. And then now she does plaintiff side med mal. And that's one thing I'll say about sort of jobs. People typically think like, oh, I want to go in-house or I want to do plaintiff side work. But that is typically the path. There are very few places in-house that hire you straight out of law school. You're mostly going to get hired in-house from a firm. And also something that's maybe a bit counterintuitive in this area is that on the plaintiff side, they mostly only hire people with pretty extensive experience. And that's because it's a huge financial gamble for them, right? So on plaintiff side, you're doing contingency work, and they're not going to put a new associate at the table when there's so much on the line for them. So they typically only, the plaintiff side lawyers typically come from defense side backgrounds. So that's MedMal. I'll say a little bit about fraud and abuse law because that's another big area of hiring. Anyone who wants to do healthcare delivery and financing law should take the fraud and abuse course because it's an important influence on the incentives that healthcare providers operate under. It's also one of the main practice areas in private practice and likely to become even bigger in terms of hiring under the Affordable Care Act, the health reform law. So fraud and abuse is a series of laws, some of which are specific to healthcare, many of which are sort of general applicability. They're fraud and abuse based on any kind of government program. But then they have applications in health law because of publicly financed programs, Medicare and Medicaid. It's something I just touched on very briefly in my version of the survey course. The adjunct taught version in the fall goes into more detail because one of the two adjuncts is primarily a fraud and abuse practitioner. So that's an area of practice where you need like the health law survey course. And then if you're really particularly interested in practicing in fraud and abuse, I would also recommend, in addition to taking the fraud and abuse course, the mergers and acquisitions course that's in the spring, which is a healthcare mergers and acquisitions course. What's sort of going on in that field right now is that under the Affordable Care Act, partly because there was a lot of interest in eliminating fraud, abuse, and waste, the HHS Office of Inspector General is given considerably greater enforcement authority under the Affordable Care Act. So there's a lot of expectation that we're entering a new era of fraud and abuse enforcement, which hopefully means more jobs for lawyers, helping providers navigate new enforcement of fraud and abuse laws. The other aspect of that is that the Affordable Care Act, one of many things that it attempts to do is restructure through incentives, not through mandates, but through incentives provided through sort of changes to Medicare payment. There's a push to encourage provider networks to work together in something called accountable care organizations. And those ACOs have a particularly nuanced set of challenges ahead of them in terms of fraud and abuse law as well as antitrust law. So that would be another course that I'd recommend outside of the health law curriculum. If you're interested in that kind of fraud and abuse for healthcare providers area, the basic antitrust course, which won't really cover healthcare issues at all, but it's a really important area to understand. We also have on the sort of, a lot of our students do go into more kind of policy-oriented health law jobs, either working with the federal government or state governments, or a lot of them going into NGOs doing healthcare advocacy. In many cases, those jobs are sort of geared toward a particular patient population or a particular population, whether it's sort of a kind of disability rights / health law organization or children's rights or women's rights or reproductive rights. For those kind of jobs, the health law survey course is a really good option, is essential. And then there's also a course called Health Law Legislative and Regulatory Process, which is a little more policy focused. That's offered in the fall with two adjuncts, who one of whom still works for the Senate Help Committee, and the other of whom used to be with FDA and then was detailed to Senate Help and now is in private practice. That's a course that's a little bit like an administrative law, advanced administrative law, focusing on health law and food and drug law. I think it works really well for people, like I said, who are interested in kind of health policy jobs on the NGO side or in government. But it also works really well if you're interested in doing government affairs work or lobbying work for a private firm, which some of our graduates have gone to do. And it focuses on, again, sort of like an advanced administrative law in the with health law and food and drug law as the context. Let's see. The other kind of area in our curriculum is bioethics, which is also mostly focused on healthcare treatment, treatment for medical conditions, but has a little bit more of an emphasis on some research as well. And bioethics is really sort of same general area, but a slightly different orientation, a different lens. Bioethics is really looking at individual rights in the context of healthcare delivery, not things like a right of access to healthcare, but rather your information, your health information privacy, informed consent, organ donation issues, when does life begin, when does life end, those kinds of issues. In terms of jobs, bioethics is a little bit tricky. There are jobs working in-house at a hospital, not in the general counsel's office, but as part of an ethics committee. There aren't a lot of those jobs, though. And then there are jobs in the federal government. One of the big ones where we've had some students doing externships, and I think we've had students getting jobs there, although I haven't been here long enough, right? At the last place I worked, there were some students who got jobs at the Office of Vaccine Litigation in the Department of Justice. So vaccine compensation for vaccine-related injuries is a big area that I would classify bioethics as sort of a course that would be important to take, as well as medical liability. I mean, a lot of students end up combining food and drug law with health law, and I think if that's your interest, it probably makes sense to mostly take the food and drug law courses and then some intellectual property courses, and then the health law survey course is kind of enough on the health law side if that's your interest. And then outside of healthcare law, then we have public health law, which is quite different. So all of the courses I've talked about so far are about medical treatment, how we pay for it, who gets it, liability for it, all of those things. Public health law is about the law of access to healthy living conditions, so things like preventing obesity, tobacco control, HIV, and using law as a tool to achieve those population-level health outcomes, so things like the Bloomberg soda ban or smoking restrictions or emergency preparedness and public health aspects of that. So I teach a seminar on that in the spring each year called Public Health Law and Policy. And then we also have one of our summer institute courses is on that. And then this year I'm teaching a seminar on global health law, which is the same sort of issues but at an international level. I don't know when that'll be offered again, possibly every other year, but we haven't made a decision about that yet. And then the last thing I'll say about our curriculum is that every year in the summer, maybe I'll pass these down. Just grab one and pass them along. Every year in the summer, we have a series of intensive courses over the course of 2 weeks at the end of June. And these are really nice for two reasons. For students like you who are just sort of deciding whether you're interested in health law, it's nice because it's sort of a low commitment way of deciding whether you are really interested in health law rather than signing up for a 4-credit survey course and then finding out that you don't like it at all. You can take a 1-credit course. Most of them are offered over the course of 2 full days. Some are offered over the course of 4 evenings. And the ones that are most sort of accessible to students like you who haven't had any kind of health law exposure yet would be the bioethics courses tend to be, so like the law and ethics of end-of-life healthcare. That's a nice way of getting a taste of healthcare financing and delivery law without the full commitment, and they're accessible issues, right? Everybody sort of has an entry point for thinking about end-of-life care. Reproductive genetics, technologies in the law is another one that kind of works fine as a standalone, even if you haven't had any exposure before. We also have a cluster of courses around pharmaceuticals in the law, which would work well, especially if you're thinking you're sort of interested in health law, but also maybe food and drug. There's a pharmaceuticals in the law course, which is organized around sort of what are all of the areas of law that are relevant to a practitioner who's representing the pharmaceutical industry. And then pharmaceutical patent protection enforcement is probably a little more advanced, not good as an entry point. But then there's a regulation of medical product communications, First Amendment and beyond. That sounds not that exciting, but it's actually really cutting edge. That's the big issue in the pharmaceutical industry right at this moment, because there's evolving First Amendment protection of commercial speech, which might allow the pharmaceutical companies to do a lot of things they couldn't do in the past. So there's a big Supreme Court decision that's coming up soon. The law and politics of health insurance exchanges, that's about a particular aspect of implementation of the health reform law. And that, I think that could work fine, even if you haven't had the health law survey class. If you're more sort of more interested in health policy, that would be a good entry point. So that's sort of the broad overview of what we offer in terms of courses. I'll just mention briefly, too, we have two student organizations that do health law work, and I think it's hugely important if you think you might be interested in practicing in this area to get involved in those groups, both to have it on your resume and so that you're getting announcements about jobs and internships and events. Really important to be part of those. One is a publication, the Health Law and Policy Brief, and the other is the Student Society, Health Law and Justice Society. They hold career panels and networking events, and they pass along all sorts of job announcements and things. So really important to get in touch with. You can contact Matt Pierce. He's kind of the continuity person on the staff side, right, because the student leaders change every year. And then finally, just as Professor Carl said, really important to get externships on your resume. I think my general advice to any students here is you should definitely do either a clinic or an externship before you graduate. In health law, I think it's externships that are going to help you a little more so than clinic. Because we don't, you know, the disability rights clinic works if you really want to do like NGO patient advocacy work. It's closely enough related to that. But other than that, none of our clinics really map that well onto the kinds of things that you'd be doing in health law practice. HHS, in my experience, I have never seen a student be hired by HHS who hasn't done externship at HHS before. And I've had students who have been told by HHS, we want to have a position for you. We think there's going to be one. You need to stay in an externship here because we cannot hire you if you're not in an externship at the moment when we want to give you that job offer. So those are really important. They're also really important. I actually think the government externships are particularly important in health law, even if you want to do private practice. I think for fraud and abuse in particular, private firms really value if you've had that externship experience on the enforcement side. The Department of Justice also has some externships that are health law related, vaccine litigation and also some fraud and abuse work. And then state and local governments, well, in DC, right, the district has its own Office of Inspector General, so you can look there for those fraud and abuse enforcement jobs too. State governments are also increasingly involved in implementing health reform, not all of them, but some of them. Maryland, locally, is pointed to as sort of the poster child for implementation. They're sort of most advanced in implementing things, so don't forget to look at the state level for those kind of policy positions as well. So there's my overview. And do you have any questions, or do you want to tell me sort of what aspects you think are interesting, or kind of where you think you might be headed, or if you just have no idea? I mean, there are so few, I feel like I could like come up with an individualized life plan for each person in this room. Yeah. So, and tell me your name.
My name's Brandon Kennard.
Okay.
So I am kind of wanting to focus on the more business and finance side of healthcare. And I noticed things like the healthcare M&A seminar and things like that. Are those the kind of things that I should be looking at, or do you have anything that really pops into your head about something that I should really focus on and take?
Yeah, so the fraud and abuse stuff is actually hugely important for the financing side, because the fraud and abuse laws dictate what kinds of arrangements providers can enter into, similar to antitrust, right? So just like antitrust provisions are going to dictate what kinds of mergers and acquisitions you can join, fraud and abuse laws also influence that. And so it's no accident that the mergers and acquisitions course and the fraud and abuse course are taught by the same adjunct, right? So I think those are really important. the privacy course might actually be important to you, because HIPAA, HIPAA's privacy rule imposes obligations on all business associates of covered entities. So you don't have to be a hospital to have significant obligations under HIPAA in terms of information transfers that might be taking place. So that can be important, I think, for thinking about business transactions among healthcare providers. If you're interested, if there are things about that side that are appealing to you, you might also think, keep your options open and think about pharmaceutical side too, because it's different, right? They're very different clients, but if you enjoy that kind of work, that you might also enjoy pharmaceutical side work, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so the survey course is probably still a good starting point, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are ways, you know, especially because I only teach the survey course in spring, right? I have to say that there are ways that you can start in the fall without starting with the health law survey course. I mean, so I've had plenty of students who've taken fraud and abuse before the survey course, and it works fine. I mean, the fraud and abuse course is sort of a very specific thing of its own. You don't necessarily have to understand the broader context to start there. The other thing I haven't talked about yet is other courses outside of health law that I recommend, and I think those are really important. I think admin law is just hugely important to health law right now, because HHS is, you know, coming out with rules, you know, weekly right now, and many of them are being challenged in court. Business associations, I think, is really important, certainly for you and for anyone, even if you're interested in sort of patient advocacy. Really important to understand those aspects. And tax is also important. If you're interested in provider side, not necessarily financing so much as delivery, or if you're interested in patient and access advocacy, ERISA is hugely important too.
And what does ERISA stand for?
It's retirement. It's Employee Retirement Income Security Act.
Okay.
It doesn't have health anywhere. Like, not, the statute doesn't say health at all.
They just kept on mentioning ERISA, and I was like, what?
Yeah, it's pension and benefits law. Okay. So the tie-in to health law is that most people in this country get their health benefits through their employment. And so even though ERISA was written with pensions in mind, right, it was written in the 70s to protect your pension, right, to ensure that it would still be there since you had been promised it and it was a benefit of your employment. But it was written in a way to apply to all employee benefits. In health law, its main effect is that it preempts state regulation of employee benefit health plans, which is what most people have. So it's got this huge preemptive effect. And the reason it gets the reason we talk about it the way we talk about it is that it's not fun for most people. It's like tax law. It's a subset of tax practice, really. And some people get really into it, and if you do, like, there are jobs for you. There really are. There are firms that have unfilled ERISA associate positions because they can't find anyone who's qualified and wants to do it. But on that, I would recommend, you know, it's really sort of take tax and then maybe take health law and take pension law and then go get one of those jobs. Any other?
Can you speak the differences in your version of the survey and the
Yeah, sure. And tell me your name.
Will.
I think we've met.
I think the very beginning
of the year. Yeah, great. Okay, at one of the like receptions. So, in theory, they are the same course, but of course they're not, right? So, we have struggled a bit to find adjuncts willing to commit to teaching a 4-credit evening course because, you know, it requires that they come twice a week, right? So we've had a little bit of turnover in that course in recent years with the adjuncts. Right now we've got, it's co-taught by two adjuncts, and they know each other really well, they work really well together, but of course there are always challenges when you're trying to co-teach a single survey course, and we're still working on that. The evaluations last year indicated that it didn't go, last year was the first year they did, this past fall, rather, and it wasn't seamless, to put it mildly, so we're still working on that. In terms of substantive coverage, the main difference is that the two adjuncts, so health law is very broad, right? And no practitioner is exposed to all of it, like by a long shot, right? Somebody tends to either be a fraud and abuse practitioner or a privacy practitioner or a med-mal practitioner. And so the two adjuncts are a privacy lawyer and a fraud and abuse lawyer, right? So you get a lot more of those two areas in their course than you do in mine. I cover privacy in 2 hours and I cover fraud and abuse in an hour. They commit more like, I think, 4 hours to privacy and for, we're negotiating right now. They initially were proposing 6 for fraud and abuse, which I think is just too much for the survey course. So we're back and forth about that. But I don't think that course, both because it's co-taught and because of their focus, it doesn't work as well for somebody who wants like the big picture policy orientation, certainly. So I try to do a lot more to kind of the big picture, kind of put everything in context. But if you know you want to do fraud and abuse, if for no other reason than to connect with the adjunct who teaches, right, because he works at the DC OIG's office, he'd be a good person to know if that's what you want to do. I mean, that would be a really good reason to take the evening course. I think those are the main differences.
I wanted to ask Layla.
And we've met, too.
I've emailed you a couple
of
times.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I wanted to ask, I'm interested in insurance law.
Okay.
And I wanted to know if the insurance law course covers health insurance quite a lot, or if it's something that I'll get enough of in the survey course.
So I have not actually spoken to, who's teaching insurance law next year?
I don't know off the top of my head.
I don't know either. So I have not spoken to whoever it is, probably. But the last time I checked, which was 2 years ago, there was very little. What's that? That's a person? GPHO?
GPHO.
Oh, okay, okay. So it's an adjunct. It's always adjunct taught.
Okay.
And so the last time I checked, which was a couple of years ago, they really didn't cover health insurance at all. If you're interested in health insurance, the survey class, and I think my version of it probably does. I covered the Affordable Care Act in more detail than the fall version does. Mm-hmm. And so I think if that's your interest, you probably want to take the spring version of the survey course. Okay. And you should also know at the outset, if you're interested in insurance law and you just want to know a little bit about health insurance almost isn't going to be insurance anymore under the Affordable Care Act. Like, it's that dramatic.
Yeah, that's
right?
Why I want to get into it.
Okay, okay. So, excellent. And I also, you know, if you continue to have this as your interest, get in touch with me separately, because a good friend of mine from law school is, like, the scholar who's doing health insurance as an insurance law issue under the Affordable Care Act. So, if you have Dan Schwartz is his name. I'd be happy to put you in touch with him. So, I don't think you're going to learn much about it in the insurance law class, and you'll learn a lot about it in the survey class. So my health law survey class, and to a lesser extent the fall version, is organized around quality, access, and cost as the main concerns. And the access section of the course is partly about the publicly financed programs like Medicare and Medicaid, but mostly about private insurance and sort of regulation of underwriting practices and then disputes over coverage that between the insured and the insurance company.
I have one more question, too.
Sure.
Can we safely assume that the courses offered in fall 2003 are also going to be offered in fall 2014?
You mean 2013 and 14?
I mean, like,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. I was like, I wasn't even near here in 2003, so I have no idea. No. I actually graduated from law school in the spring of 2003, so generally, yes. It's mostly stable from year to year. We've had some courses, some of the, like, medical liability and privacy have moved semesters sometimes, so we try to make sure they're offered every year. The global health law course is in flux. That one was offered this spring. It might not be offered again. It might be in every other year, or it might be in every 3 years course. We'll see. But for the most part, I mean, you can't necessarily assume which semester something will be in as consistent for the smaller courses. But for the most part, it's pretty stable from year to year.
Can you speak at all about the health law disability, or I'm sorry, the mental health disability course?
So I help recruit adjuncts and do oversight for certain health law courses, but that's not one of them. That one is mostly designed by Bob Dinnerstein and sort of on the disability side, but I've been copied on the emails, so I guess I could say what I've gleaned from being copied on emails. That's a course that's partly health law, but partly a lot of other things, right? So there's a lot of, like, criminal justice system stuff that comes into play in mental disability in the law. And then some of it is kind of access side, sort of mental health parity for access to healthcare, partly discrimination and disability discrimination issues in terms of institutions versus community-based care, that kind of thing. If you're interested in, we've had some students and recent graduates who have done really well with finding great jobs at that intersection of disability rights and health law. There are a lot of NGOs right now that are really interested in those issues, particularly with the implementation of health reform. And that's partly because states have obligations under the health reform law to reach out to underserved populations through the Navigator program that sort of brings people into the insurance exchange. So NGOs are really actively involved in all of that. I think if that's the area you're interested in, take a lot of disability courses and then take the survey course probably from me, because again, because if you're more sort of on the policy side, I think you're going to do better in the spring version of the health law survey course, because it's more big picture policy oriented than the evening fall version, which is a little more sort of very practice, very practical in orientation, really gets into the nitty gritty in those two areas in particular. Yeah. And what was your name?
Garrett.
Nashville. Yes.
I was planning out my next 2.5 years.
Only 2.5?
Just class-wise.
Sure.
So what's a good balance to strike? Because, I mean, there's a lot of classes that I've been advised to take, just, you know, marketing courses, you know, like Comfort Plus is really good to retain the bar. Is there a good balance? So there's not a lot of room for a ton of movement. What would you say is a good balance?
So I have to be careful what I say about not taking courses, right? I don't want to advise you not to take anything, or that you don't need to take anything that other people have advised you to take. I think in terms of bar prep, I mean, that's a decision you have to make for yourself individually. You have to decide about yourself. Am I the kind of person who can take certain subject areas and just decide that I'm going to teach myself what I need to know for the bar, or do I need a full course to be ready, right? And that's something only you can answer for yourself. That said, I think it's quite feasible for at least some students who can sort of stay on task and stay organized about it to teach themselves some of the things that are on the bar, right? I think business associations is an important and underappreciated course that most people should take. Although it's an area that you could expose yourself to, right, that you could decide on your own to figure out, but only if you're really committed to doing that. I think it's important to understand it to be able to understand a lot of private law areas and business law areas. In terms of balance, I mean, in admin law, I also think I think admin law almost should be a required course because it's unlike anything else that you're doing, and it's important to so many areas. I mean, as federal regulation of the financial sector and the health law sector and everything else expands, you've got to understand admin law to understand it, not for bar reasons, right, but in terms of practice. I think in terms of balance with specialized courses, one of the things I like about the summer institutes, and health law isn't the only one, there's also an environmental law one and an IP law one, is it lets you get, I do think it's really helpful and really advantageous to get those specialized courses on your transcripts in an area where you want to practice. And the institutes let you do that with low credit commitment, right? As opposed to taking sort of, you know, 10 credits in an area, you can take one or two and get those courses on your transcript. I mean, one of the advantages that we have here, because we're a big law school, we can offer more courses. I mean, we just have more course offerings than most law schools do. And what that means is we have more specialized course offerings than most law schools do. And what that means is when you go apply for a job, they can look at your transcript and see that you've taken, you know, courses that are things that normally they would have to help you learn on the job. So that's an advantage, but you're right, that you have to then balance that out. And I think partly it's got to be about sort of knowing yourself and knowing, you know, am I the kind of student who can set some things aside, some foundational things aside, and just know that I'm going to figure them out either on my own to make sure I'm making sense of the courses I'm taking, specialized courses I'm taking, or for the bar. And I think that's a balance, right? I mean, one of the difficult things about how many courses we offer is that you've got to make these choices. But it's a good dilemma to have.
So kind of, I think you touched on this earlier, the path that I kind of wanted to take was doing like private firm and then getting into AIM Council.
Yeah.
As far as externships to kind of lead you to that path, looking looking for the summer, like I secured an internship, but it has absolutely nothing to do with anything medicine related to
Yeah. Topics,
because I found it really hard to secure internships when you have not even taken any kind of foundational course.
Sure.
When my undergrad major was in business. So what would you recommend, like after, I guess, taking the health survey course in the fall, will that kind of put you into a position of applying for externships in the health field?
Yeah, I mean, I think, even, you know, in your 2L year, if you can even get anything that's health specific on your resume, even by joining the student organizations,
right.
You know, joining the health law and policy brief, I think that helps, right? As soon as possible to get that kind of stuff,
yeah.
That kind of indication on your resume.
That.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So you're good. And then, I mean, the Summer Institute, again, is also a way to get something on your transcript right away so that even if you're applying for fall externships, it's already on your transcript. In terms of the kinds of externships, there's a big list that they have in the externship office. It's also on the bulletin board outside my office door of all the organizations that you can explore for externships. I think one of the big advantages of being in D.C. is that you're not just thinking about the summers, right? Because
right.
You only have two summers, but you have fall
yeah,
and spring externships you can do as well.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to the government externships, there's Inova Health Systems is a place where people have been able to get internships in the summer sometimes locally, and then some of the NGO groups. Mostly those are sort of aimed at specific populations, but if you're interested in doing, I mean, if that's the path you're interested in, you're probably looking at doing a combination of medical malpractice and more general sort of fraud and abuse, you know, being familiar with all of that too. So. So one option would be to take the fraud and abuse course right away, and that shows like real commitment, right? Because the survey course, lots of dabblers take the survey course, but very few dabblers take the fraud and abuse course. There's also on fraud and abuse, there's the pharmaceuticals cluster in the summer, but there's also a fraud and abuse cluster, and I think those two things are sort of interchangeable. So there's a 3-credit fall course you can take, or you can take anywhere between 1 and 3 separate 1-credit courses in the summer. And one of those 1-credit courses in the summer, the most advanced one, right? So you'd have to take at least the intro level 1-credit fraud and abuse that's taught by the same professor who teaches the fall course, Shelzo. If you take that one, then you can sign up for the OIG workshop, which is taught, I mean, it's specifically aimed at the new changes in enforcement, and it's taught by HHS attorneys. And that one's likely to have a lot of practitioners in it as well, which is a nice networking opportunity. I mean, it's one thing to meet somebody after a panel. It's another thing to sit in a class with them for 14 hours and you know, really have a chance to engage substantively with somebody. So that, I guess that would be my main advice. Like, get something on your transcript that's not just the survey course pretty early on, because that plus the student organizations, I think, really goes a long way. And also, I don't know, try to get to know me so that then I can make calls on your behalf, but I mean, that sounds really awful, right?
Makes sense.
In any field in which you're interested, it's always beneficial to have substantive engagement with the faculty here, because then we can make calls on your behalf and have something real to say other than just, she seemed really interested when she came to the course selection meeting.
So would you recommend then taking, in order to apply for spring internships or something more substantive in the health field, would you recommend taking fraud and abuse first for fall semester and then taking the health law survey course?
Well, I'm a little biased, right? Because
right.
I want all of you to read my fall survey course. But either, I mean, 7 credits would be a lot to do
right.
your first fall.
Yeah.
If you know that you want to do sort of provider side work, I would say for you, take the fall fraud and abuse and then take the spring survey. And if you're here in D.C. for the summer, take maybe one of the summer intensives. And if you take only one in that field, well, you're going to take the 3-credit fraud and abuse. So I would do maybe law and ethics of end-of-life healthcare would actually not be a bad one, because bioethics would be another area it'd be good to sort of touch on, but you wouldn't necessarily want to take the full bioethics course during the semester. But that 1-credit, that's the issue where hospitals have the most kind of exposure to liability too. So I think that would be a good one. Any other sort of individual counseling needs? It's like a one-on-one session. This is actually better than last year. There were 3 people. There were 3 students and the 3 of us. And
Yeah, this is a very
well, that's just sad.